Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 8.
Len, you were telling us about your homecoming, and you surprised Eve by coming home too early.
Yes, instead of being all glamorous with her hair done, her hair was still in curlers, and she could, although she was pleased to see me, she said, "You could have come later when I was looking better than this." Anyway,
And how long had you been away at this
two
stage?
2 years, a couple of years. So I was pleased to get back, but she was, as I realised then, she was suffering from MS. I didn't know what it was called then, but she was, she couldn't do things for herself. She had to get a neighbour to cut the slices of bread for her, and my little baby daughter, who had left as a baby, or a little young baby of a few months old, was now a little girl of 4, and because I'd been to America before going overseas, you see, so that was a double whammy of being away from home, and this, I remember a little incident where sitting on the settee next to Eve talking, and my little daughter Anne came and squeezed in between us and said to Eve, "Is this man always going to be with us?" And he said, "Yes, this is the daddy of the photograph you've been kissing every night." Yes. Are we on?
We are.
Yes, it was the end of October, October the 27th, that I went to Uphaven to join 74 course of the, I think it was the 7 Flying Instructor School, Uphaven. And coincidentally, the first instructor there was a flying officer, Perry, who had been a PC a young lad who went across with me to train in America as a pilot. And he obviously got through successfully and joined the Central Flying School as an instructor. And we were flying Airspeed Oxfords, which was a twin-engine plane that was equipped with all the instruments that could be used, operational flying. And one of the courses that we went on, or we did with them, I did, was a blind flying course. You know, when you fly on the lights. I can't think of the blooming name of... Anyway, I went through that course. At the end of course was satisfactory. I was then posted...
Sorry, before you leave that, there was a number of other police officers.
Oh,
on that,
yeah, there were. There was Bruce Dix. He was one of the instructors. He was one of the instructors there, and obviously his mentality was instructing, because he eventually became instructor at Hendon Training School and was commandant of the cadet training section. And I know when he retired, I invited him to come to our reunion, but he was living up in the island of Skye. He and his wife had moved up to Skye, and it was too far for them to come down. But he was very sorry, and he did get in touch with me, and I filled him in with all the lists of the people who'd attended, and the tape that I'd taken of the service and the speeches. So he knew all about it, but he didn't come down. And there was a couple of others, Windmill, I'm not sure, he was a policeman somewhere, and Bob Acott. They had finished their tours and, like me, went on instruction. But I don't know what happened to them after that, and I don't think we've never had any reunions of Uphaven, so that was an episode that was towards the end of my flying career, except that I went on to... Western on the Green was on the 20 pilots Air Force training, operational training unit, and I must admit that was some of the most dodgy flying that I've experienced all my flying career, teaching other people all the things that can happen, like a single engine failure on takeoff, and what you do if you have to make a false landing, a power landing, a precautionary landing, where you fly full power, dragging on the aircraft and landing in a field just over a hedge. You know, it's all right when you're doing it yourself, but when it's in the hands of a young new pilot, it's very dodgy. So when VE time came, when victory in Europe and we weren't any longer required to train pilots, and I took my release from the Air Force, because all this time I'd only been seconded to the Air Force. I was still a policeman and seconded to the Air Force, and therefore I could take Class A release or Class B release, and B release was an immediate release back into your job. And as I had achieved quite high marks as a pilot and was above average in my assessments, I thought it would be quite nice to stay in the Air Force and make it a career as a permanent pilot in the Air Force, or even civil aviation. But when I made application, I found that I was just a year too old. I was 31 by then, and I had to be 30 or under to have got a permanent commission in the RAF. So I thought, well, there's only one thing for it, and that's to go back to the police force. And I went back to see my old superintendent at Putney, and I forget his name, and he said, Len, he said, you take my advice and you come back as quickly as you can. You'll be on the crest of the wave as far as promotion is concerned, and you'll be up the ladder in no time at all. Because I had taken my sergeant's exam prior to going into the Air Force in 1938. I'd taken my civil service exam and sergeant's exam and passed that, and was waiting for a posting. But unfortunately, when I did take Class B relief and went back to the station, the superintendent himself had retired, and there was another one there, and he said, I'm sorry, I know none of you. He said, I'm going to take you in the order I come across you and promote you according to age and circumstances. And so I went back to Putney and again had a very dodgy time. I went back to driving, and I think two major events there. One was there was a burglary or a shop breaking in Putney High Street, and being the wireless car driver, I went to that, and a colleague of mine, Leslie Brown, he was the van driver, and he'd gone before me and got up on the roof, the flat roofs at the back of the shops on the east side of Putney High Street, and we saw this chap climbing along. I remember his name. He was called Ginger. Oh, God, I thought I had remembered his name. Les Brown called me. I got up on the roof. He said, Len, he's going that way. Will you get over that roof and go and cut him off that way? Well, I did. I went to get over the flat roof onto the next flat roof, but there wasn't a flat roof there. I fell down to the ground, crashed down about 18, 20 feet below, and hurt myself considerably, but nevertheless gathered myself up and continued the chase, and eventually got the bloke back at the station. And then I went home and was in severe pain. I said, I'll have to go and see the doctor. And I did, and he sent me up to St. Thomas's Hospital, and they said, oh, you've got an impacted sacroiliac joint. And they gave me, over a period of time, they gave me deep ray treatment to try and kill this pain. And I cut a long story short, many years later I found that I hadn't just impacted my sacroiliac joint, I'd fractured my pelvis bone, severed it all, folded it back, and so today it's about an inch and a half lower, further back than the other one. So that was one of the first memorable events, coming back. And then shortly afterwards, driving the wireless car, this was in 1946, there was a call to the Earl Spencer public house. The night duty policeman on the beat had found or seen lights in the pub, And also he'd found that there was a car parked up in the side turning beside the pub on the 22 bus stop terminal, all with its engine running, or at least the doors open and the engine heated, ready for a quick getaway. And he realised that there were burglars in the pub. So the message to the car was approach with caution and leave the car in Erpingham Road and approach through the church passage. Well, we did this, and my navigator, my wireless operator at the time was a chap called excuse me for forgetting. Yes, and my operator was Hugh Duncan, who was a qualified radio Morse operator. They were very few and far between, but he had been on sick leave because he was damaged and had head injuries after the bombing of the section house. He'd been in the section house at Putney when it was bombed, and one of the officers was killed and he received damage. But anyway, he was with me on that occasion in the car, and so I said to Hugh, I said, look, you stay with the car, Hugh, and get your truncheon out, and if anyone comes back to it, don't hesitate to attack them and stop them getting into the car. So I cautiously approached the pub, and the PC who was waiting for me was over in the police box on the other side. We approached the pub from two directions, he to the north side and I to the west side of the pub. And as we did so all hell broke loose. Chairs were, the windows were smashed all the way around the two sides. Obviously using a chair, they smashed them through the plate glass windows. And there were three all told. One of them jumped out and ran along Lower Richmond Road in Putney Bridge direction, and the PC chased him, but unfortunately never caught him or never found him. The other two came out of the corner window of the pub, and one of them had a gun in his hand, and I went towards them, but he stuck the gun towards me. He said, you move your bust and you've had it. And they started running up towards their car, where poor old Hugh was guarding, and I thought, two of them I must follow. So I followed them and zigzagged as much as I could, and they fired at me over their shoulder. I had six shots fired at me on that trip between leaving the front of the pub up the 100 yards up to the up to their stationary car. And again, fate must have been on my side, because all those six shots missed me. And as I got up there, I felt one of them had hit Hugh Duncan on the head again, and laid him out. And so I took a dive in and got the other one. And the other one who had the gun ran up and eventually got onto the railway line. And obviously he dumped the gun up there. And the one that I caught, I took back to the station. And this was... His name was Alec Canning Costander. He was known as the Count in the underworld. Quite a notorious gang. But I'm afraid in those days the CID weren't very interested in catches from via uniform branch, because it meant a lot of work for them and no credit at the end of it. So there was no search made for the other man or the effort to find out who the third member of the crew was that escaped. I don't think they even searched for the gun. Anyway, eventually, Alec Canning Costander was charged, and we went up to the Old Bailey. And like all these cases where there's a gang, they had nobbled one of the jurors somehow or other, and the jury couldn't come to a verdict. And there was a fresh trial, had to go to a fresh trial. And knowing what had happened the first one, they did get a jury that was unnobblable the next time. And I think he got 6 years that. And I always remember the defense counsel saying to me, can we see your notebook about this event, all these events that you're telling us about? And I said, I said, I'm sorry, I was so exhausted after the running and the chasing and the events of my companion being hit that I didn't take any notes. I said, but the events are so vivid in my mind that I can remember them to this day. And the old judge supported me. He said, what a silly question to ask. How does an officer need to write notes about an event like that? You know, he did support me. And Costanda got, as I say, 6 years. But the follow-up to that was one of my pals, who was a fellow driver in the station that night, was Geoffrey Whitfield. And he eventually, he'd passed for his sergeant's exam. He eventually became a sergeant at Chelsea. And, or was it when he was an inspector? He eventually got to inspector. But Costanda and six others escaped from Wormwood Scrubs. They made their escape and they were free for some considerable time when Geoffrey Whitfield, walking round Sloane Square, saw a Rolls Royce coming round the square, and he saw the driver, and he saw the driver. He looked very much like this Costanda who he'd met in the charge room when he was charged. And so, you know, Geoffrey was not one to let things pass. He got in touch with the car registration office and found out who had registered the car, who it's registered by. And although it was registered in the name of nursing sisters Pearl and Moira Aberg, who had a nursing home beside Hampstead Police Station, but it was registered in the name of Dr. Canning. And Geoffrey put two and two together, Alec Canning Costanda, and there was this car being driven by Dr. Canning. So he got passed the news on to the squad, the CID and the squad, and they made one raid up to this house, the nursing home. Were unlucky, but a second time they were convinced that he was about, they picked up Canning again, hiding under a bed in one of the bedrooms. So Alec Canning resumed his prison sentence. But that was that event had a very sad ending, because Hugh Duncan eventually finished up in a mental home in Edinburgh, which was his home, and he died in a mental home from brain damage. And I wondered if he's still got a wife alive and a son, but it was a sad end to one of my close friends. But there again, I carried on for a while at Putney as a driver.
Ben, did you find it hard to adjust back to sort of civilian police life after your
well, service? In a way, yes, because it was a big leap from being flight lieutenant and having a batman in your room to help you and things like that, to being back a PC again at everyone's beck and call at Putney. But of course, strange to say, there was not a great deal of support for people who had been away in the forces by the people who had stayed at home. They somehow thought that we'd had a cushy time and we'd missed all the bombing, and the fact that we'd survived, they didn't realise that we'd been through as much as that. It was really survival, and we never spoke about our service life at all back in the police force, and many of us never wore our medal ribbons, except that when I eventually got to Kensington as an inspector, they insisted that I wore them, because I was appointed as an inspector. I was a liaison officer with I was a troubleshooter there, and given jobs which they said that I should have my medal ribbons on. So, but a lot of people didn't wear them because of this antipathy towards the people who had been away in the forces by those who had to stay at home in the Blitz. It was sour grapes on a lot of occasions, because many of them had applied for Air Force duties and hadn't been accepted. But
And when was it that you actually left Putney on promotion?
It was 1948. I went up to, posted to Notting Hill as a sergeant at Notting Hill, and there again had some wonderful experiences, you know, experience-wise. I was there during the time of the Evans murders and the Christie case and the Evans case and the Hague case and the Heath case and a number of other big murders, although as uniform. I was there during that time, and I was working a lot of that time in plain clothes because the CO there, what's his name, Station Inspector Harry Mortimer, he picked me to run a complaint squad, or a vice squad, as it called. And he probably realised that the CID deal with all indictable crimes, but there's a lot of crimes like bookmaking and prostitutes and poncing and brothels and all that sort of thing that they can't deal with, or they didn't deal with in those days. And so a vice squad had to deal with that sort of thing, and that's, I spent a lot of my time at Notting Hill running the vice squad.
Tell me a little bit more about the Christie case, because I believe that you were quite closely involved in
it. Yes, in fact, I know the full story, which has never been told, and I feel at some stage should be recorded, because it was too sordid, and I think it was Inspector Knight, was it, who was in charge of the Christie case, was a very straight-laced gentleman, and he didn't want the sordid side of the case to be spoken about. But in fact, while I was running this vice squad in North Kensington, a lot of it in Westbourne Grove, where the prostitutes hang out, and I, on one occasion, was in Lancaster Road, which was close by, and saw a coloured man steal a box of biscuits from outside a baker's shop and ran away, and I ran after him and took him into... He landed up in 10 Rillington Place, and I went in 10 Rillington Place and followed him upstairs. The door was open. I followed him where I could hear him, and I found him under the bed, and... I asked him what he was doing under there. He said, "I'm saying my prayers." Anyway, I took him back to Putney and charged him with larceny. And I thought, well, I'd better go back and tell the owner of the house that I've arrested one of his tenants. So after this man was charged, I went back to see the house and saw Christie. And spoke to him standing in the front room there. And I said I'd arrested one of his tenants. I said, "What a terrible stink there is in your house, Christie." He said, "You always see all these bloody niggers upstairs." Now, I've told this story once before when Central Television were doing a program about it, and I was not allowed to say niggers. You know, I said it was, I had to change it to one of these tenants upstairs, because, you know, it was one talking for public television, one has to be careful about what one says. But talking as factually as I am to you, it's what happened there. And so when later on the Christie murder took place, and I went to the house, I realised that I'd been talking to Christie in the front room over the place where his wife was buried under the floorboards and decaying and smelling terrible there. And that was why I spoke to him about the terrible smell in the house. So when the murder eventually... There was, first of all, the Christie murder, the Evans murder, which was in that house. And all I know about that, you know, it was dealt with by the CID. They got telephone messages from the West Country where Evans had run away to after the event of his wife's death, and I know that we're searching for Mrs. Evans's body. They were looking in manholes in the street, but eventually it proved to be in the back of the house, in an old lavatory behind some wood, that they found a body. But I did sit with, as was the normal practice, I did sit with Evans in the cell after he'd been charged and after the case had been documented and everything else, his statements taken. Because once a murderer, as you know, he's got to be accompanied in the cell at all times. And I sat and chatted to him in a very casual way. And I said to him, I can understand you possibly getting away with doing away with your wife because she was unfaithful or because she'd had another baby. I said, but I can't understand you killing your daughter Geraldine. He said, well, without its mother, he said that Geraldine's crying got on my nerves so much, crying incessantly. He said, I just put my hand around its throat and strangled it to stop it crying. I thought, well, you may be in doubt about the murder of your wife, but there's certainly no doubt about the murder of your baby. You've admitted it. So the fact that he got off and was acquitted by Ludwig Kennedy, well, at least Ludwig Kennedy campaign got him off the murder. I know he was a murderer and murdered his own daughter. Now, when it came to the Christie murder, one thing I did know that wasn't brought out in any of the trials, that Mrs. Christie was the abortionist to all the prostitutes in that area, the ones that I'd used to deal with in Westbourne Grove and so on. I knew from a long time standing that Mrs. Christie was the abortionist for all those prostitutes. So when it came to eventually the case over Mrs. Christie's murder, I knew that all those bodies that were talked about in the garden and elsewhere were the result of Mrs. Christie's deeds of abortion. But I'll tell you the procedure. When a girl came in for abortion, they took her into the kitchen, and there was an old deck chair there with strings across it, and I think it's still in the Madame Tussauds gallery, I'm not sure, but I think the kitchen has been reproduced in Madame Tussauds, and the kitchen and the cupboard where they found the bodies decaying at the bottom. Anyway, Mr. and Mrs. Christie used to put the girl in one of these chairs, lift the chair up, the front two legs up onto the kitchen table, so the girl's legs were hanging open, and Mrs. Christie used to perform the abortion while Christie himself administered very ineffective and dangerous chloroform, well, coal gas. He had an old rubber tube that came up from the gas fire beside in the side of the room, a rubber tube with at the end of it was a tin can cut out to fit over the girls like a mask. And he used, I think there was an intervening cell or a tin with something to make it less obnoxious, you know, less noxious. But anyway, this can used to be put over the girl's face until they passed out, and then Mrs. Christie would perform the abortion. In many cases, as we know, she failed. And the girls, anyway, when they'd finished with them, the girls were taken into the front room to either recover or to die. And this is where Christie incurred the wrath of his wife, because he used to have sexual intercourse with the dying or dead bodies in the front room. He was a necrophiliac. And it was when his wife realized what he was doing that she was going to blow the whistle on him. And this is why he murdered her. Because if she'd have revealed this story, it would have come out publicly that he was a necrophiliac and screwing dead bodies. So that's why Mr. Black said, look, we've got the evidence to charge him with killing his wife. We don't want anything else. We'll leave that, providing we get a conviction on killing his wife, that's all we want to know about this job. So all the bodies they dug up in the back garden and the bodies of the women under the cupboard in the kitchen were irrelevant to the charge in hand, but were picked upon by people after the case as sort of why wasn't this done? Why wasn't that done? But in fact, I know that it was because Mr. Black didn't want the sordid